Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hi, this is David Frangioni, CEO and publisher of Modern Drummer Magazine. So excited about our new podcast, the Modern Drummer Podcast. This weekly podcast will bring Modern Drummer to life. Sit back and enjoy fresh, fun, and insightful conversations with today's top drummers, producers, musicians, beatmakers, and craftsmen. Whether you're a professional, a hobbyist, drummer, musician, programmer, producer, or just love music, this show is for you. Every other week, the Modern Drummer Podcast will feature world-renowned producer, songwriter, and drummer, Narda Michael Walden. Narda Michael Walden's Upbeat is featured exclusively on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Hey, everybody. This is your brother, Narda Michael Walden. And we're presenting a brand new edition for Upbeat with Modern Drummer Magazine. And we're very thrilled and excited to be presenting for this week's show a gentleman I found on the YouTube. And he blew my mind. His name is Aubrey Dale. Aubrey Dale is a brilliant drummer. But what impressed me, I think, the most was he took from 1975 recording of the Cosmic Strut, My Vision Orchestra, Visions of the Emerald Beyond album. He took the piece called Cosmic Strut, wrote it out, transcribed it, and was able to play it back reading his writing. That blew my mind because I can't do that. That he could do that was incredible to me. And play it the way he plays it, I was like, wow. So I wanted to have him featured on our Upbeat. So please watch and see the story of how this man's mind can work, that he can do this, which is to me quite phenomenal. Aubrey Dale, everybody. Have a great, great time listening to the story of Aubrey. Bye-bye.
You, the miracle worker. Yes, I do. I say, Aubrey Dale. I call you the miracle worker on them drums. Yes, I do. I never know nobody transcribe what I played on them things. I never know nobody can play what I played on them recordings the way you do. And you touch my heart, and you touch my soul, Aubrey, Aubrey Day. Ooh, yeah, yeah. I call you the miracle worker.
And we send love to Julie for saving your life. Aubrey Dale. Aubrey Dale.
Cosmic Struts. It's the first thing I heard you do, bro. How are you, my great man?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I was already starstruck. Now I don't know what to do with myself.
I love you so much, man. I'm really impressed by you, and I want to take a time with you, a lesson with you, so I can learn some things that you know, that you studied your life, because you really have studied, and you're a bachelor degree, and you know all the things that are really important for me to know as well. So God bless you.
Oh, God bless you. My goodness. I don't know. Wow. That was an incredible intro.
Thank you, man.
The intro of intros.
So let me ask you, if you don't mind, our fans want to know about you. I've already said in my little song that when I heard you play Cosmic Strut and you, I mean, literally you found a way to dissect the thing, which I think is quite complicated, but and you found it like it's a piece of cake in a way. So I was just so taken back that you can do that and play with it with the freedom and the relaxation you can play with. I'm like blown away by your playing.
Oh my God.
And so I want to just hear from you anything you want to say to our listeners and our fans today.
Well, you know, as far as the transcribing, it's well, the first thing is, you know, I've been playing a real long time. I used to live in America. I live in Canada now. I live outside Toronto. I used to live in New York City. And, you know, all the playing I did, and it was a very hectic, busy, fast life, as you're well aware of, right? Yeah. Running around the world and so forth. Yeah. And I never took the time, even though I gained a lot of the, you know, some of the skills to do, as you said, to do what I do, I kind of put it like in a filing cabinet and was just out there playing, you know? Mm. And I guess the last like 5 years, I said to myself, you know what? You should really go back mm-hmm. and listen to your heroes and see what they were really, what were they doing? You know, mm-hmm. see what was really going on. Mm-hmm. I studied with John Riley at mm-hmm. Manhattan School of Music, mm-hmm. you probably know. Mm-hmm. And he always said to me, you know, transcribing is like putting on someone's coat.
Right.
You know, it's like you go up to that person, hey, can I borrow your coat for a minute? You know, you put it on and it's, you know, kind of feels different because you know, everyone's structure is different. You know, mm-hmm. some people are big, short, large, skinny. Mm-hmm. and it's interesting and wow, this is how you wear your coat. This is nice. Mm-hmm. And you might go, you know, I'm gonna get a coat that has some of those features. I'm gonna look for a coat like that has some of those. Oh, let me try your coat on. You know, so I started to transcribe more and more. And he's right. That's exactly how it feels, you know. So it feels like you're experiencing what that drummer captured at that moment. A recording mm-hmm. is just a snapshot in time, right?
Yes, yes.
It's just a snapshot. So it's like at that time, that drummer felt this way and played these notes and had this spirit and this feeling. And, you know, when you do that, you take a little piece of that with you. I mean, you mm-hmm. can't be that person, you can't play like that person, mm-hmm. but you get a sense of how they
yes.
think and feel.
Yes.
So, you know, of course I'm perusing through the drummers, you know, Art Taylor, Steve Smith, Billy Cobb, I'm going through all these, and then I says, wait a minute. One day, I know what I got to check out, Narada Michael Walden. Mm-hmm. So I sat down with my favorite song on Visions of the Emerald Beyond, Cosmic Strut. Mm-hmm. At the time, not knowing that it was your song. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that because on the album cover, children, there's these things called records.
They come right, exactly.
They're big, they have liner notes, it's right. a concept. But you know, on the liner notes were very sparse on my edition, and it didn't say who wrote what. right? So only found that out from you. And oh, by the way, before I keep going with this whole thing, I just want to give a huge shout out to Grant Calvin Weston, our mutual friend.
Okay, great. Yeah, great.
Putting you in touch with me. Mm-hmm. That brother is close to my heart, and yeah. I'm just really happy that, you know, he saw fit to give you a heads up.
Very good. Okay. Wonderful. You know?
But yeah, so I came across Cosmic Strut, and believe me, actually, it's not a simple feat. You made it sound like I just breezed through it. It's not just breeze through it. Okay. You know, it was exciting to me because I could hear what you were doing, and more than what you were doing, but what you were feeling. You were very young at that time, right?
Yeah, we had just turned, I think, 22.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Like, and that was the first song I've ever had on record, is Cosmic Strut. The first song on record, yeah.
And you must have been just like, it's almost like a dream. I could hear your excitement. I could hear
because at that time we had just finished big tour. The first album was Apocalypse from Mavish Orchestra in 74 for me. And then we toured. And the touring really gave me strength and my confidence to really come strong. So when we made the second album, Visions of the Emerald Beyond, we're now in Jimi Hendrix studio, Electric Ladyland Studios, with Ken Scott, the great Beatle engineer, and of course John McLaughlin, the great, you know, producer, songwriter, visionary genius.
Of course.
And all these songs he's bringing in that on that album. And he allowed me to bring in the Cosmic Strut. And we first cut it on the clavinet. And he played guitar with Jean-Luc Ponty on violin and Ralph Armstrong on bass.
Yeah,
and then I overdubbed drums. And it was just really a fantastic time in my life because I felt like a tiger. I felt like I could just really just come out. You know, when you tour and you play with Mahavishnu or like that, then you really get your strength and your feeling up. So that album, I came along kind of strong. That's what it was.
But it was,
that's what it was.
It's a good thing.
And it's a good thing. Okay, cool. Thank
you. So it just had this fire that is, so I wanted to pull apart, you know, more technically what was going on. And it was so exciting to me just to see how you like launch into these roles. And I could just tell that it was from here, not from here. Mm. You know, that's what I took from that performance, especially. So I just, you know, went through it and just took my time, you know, figuring out the sticking and just doing that was interesting, just to see sort of where you were at, you know, like in terms of your level and what you were doing at that time, and see just how you not just how you felt behind the drums, like from emotionally, but technically some of the things that you were working on, you know.
Yes.
I could really hear it.
Yes.
It really came through clean and clear, my brother.
Thank you so much, Aubrey. Yeah. Thank you so much, Aubrey. Yeah. Well, Aubrey, God bless you, man. Tell us about your love with the drum, how you first got started with the whole thing. I know you're a bit of a prodigy playing accordion and piano when you're 5 years old. So talk about your basic early life for a moment, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, we're my family's a first generation to Canada. We moved first of all, dig this. We moved to Northern Alberta from Jamaica. So you can just imagine that landing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was my first memories of being a very young child is seeing snow out the window of the airplane.
Wow.
Yeah. Coming from Jamaica. So
Moved
to Montreal. And I grew up in a suburb of Montreal called Pointe-Claire.
Okay.
So to be honest, you know, my childhood was pretty great, actually. My mom was a teacher, a high school teacher, and my dad was in real estate. A friend of his from Jamaica had a real estate company, and he just slipped into that. And, you know, we had the Leave It to Beaver lifestyle, except for the black. That was the only difference.
Yeah.
And we had accents, which I lost very quickly.
Okay.
You know, and so, you know, coming up, playing the accordion, as you said, and around 13, I don't know where it came from, because I hadn't really paid attention to the drums as a young kid, but suddenly it's all I could think about. I can't explain it. Not only was all I could think about, but I just knew how to do it. I just knew how to play. So a friend of mine brought over a kick drum and a snare drum and gave me some sticks. And we played Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis Presley.
Wow.
You know? And I knew the shuffle. Pardon me. I knew how to play a shuffle just from hearing it. And then when I got a hi-hat, I knew what to do with that. It was really weird, you know? It was like I'd played it before. That probably happened to you too. And, you know, so I had my high school band with my friends, and we were learning Led Zeppelin songs and Black Sabbath songs and, you know, Bad Company songs.
Right.
Took our shots at Van Halen and even Rush, you know? I learned how to play 2112. Mm-hmm. I like to hear those tapes now. I wonder how I did.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and then my mom, because she's a teacher, is like, okay, so this drumming thing, clearly this is something you got to do. So she sent me the McGill Conservatory, bless her. And that's where I started to really get into music properly, ear training and theory. And so by the time I, you know, went to McGill, to university, I'd done a lot of that. So I found university, not easy, but I had a foundation. So it wasn't taxing, which means that I could play more. Right. And believe it or not, I didn't really play the drums. I studied classical percussion.
Okay. Yeah. Timpani and glockenspiels and things. Yeah. Wonderful.
That was it. I didn't even think I was going to be a drummer, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to stay in that world. And I got to be honest, you know, to my classical brothers and sisters, it was a tough, what would I say? A tough social makeup, you know, for a black person in that world. Mm. For those who stuck it out and are successful, you know, that's a blessing. But it wasn't easy, you know. Okay. So I decided I was going to play the drums.
Okay.
And I got sort of go back home. And, you know, because I'd been listening to drummers like you, Billy Cobham, Tony Williams, Art Blakey. I had a teacher when I was around 15, 16, who used to take me to see Art Blakey when he came through town.
Oh, you saw him?
Yeah, you know.
You saw him.
And he had, because he, Art Blakey and Elvin, he knew Elvin really well. My teacher's name was Ronnie Page. And he would sit me in, there was like, in this place, it was called the Rising Sun. Like, you know, one of those really small clubs, probably fit 50 people, 60 people.
Yeah.
And Elvin and his groups in there, and there was a seat that was right near the hi-hat, much like in the Vanguard. You know, the Village Vanguard, they had that band. And he would sit me in that seat. So I'd be about, you know, 4 or 5 feet from Elvin's hi-hat. So I could see everything. And, you know, I didn't really get what he was doing, but I knew I could key into the energy and the I could key into it. I said, that's it. I have to get to that somehow. This is, that's like the end of the story. I have to get there somehow. So, you know, that was a huge influence on me. And seeing Art Blakey as well, and Tony Williams too, used to come to town.
Well, how old would you be now? Just so I'm understanding. So how old are you?
Between 15 and 18.
Wow. The prime years.
Yeah. And a lot of my friends were really into drummers and stuff. And we used to, you know, you'd have like boom boxes with Elvin in it, cranking in the car, you know, weather report. You know, I was really into Peter Erskine and Omar.
Yes.
And of course, Mahavishnu, between you and Billy, just, you know, wore those records out. Just checking
out. How did you go? Because see, first on, you mentioned like Bad Company and the more the rock stuff, right?
Yeah. But
then you said, then you saw Art Blakey, you saw Elvin. How did you kind of go into more of the jazz side from all the rock you were into?
Yeah, it was like a switch, you know, because you're right. I was really into John Bonham, really into John Bonham, and really into Neil Peart, you know, like massively. I even, you know, when I was in school, I'd put, you know, chimes behind me, and I'd have orchestra bells, and I'd get, you know, bell trees, just like he used to use. And we'd write these little songs that would have that stuff in it. I was really into it. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm sure a lot of guys were, you know, people were in the suburbs especially. And then, you know, I just, my sister, this is like my sister, my late sister Charmaine, she was very intense, this woman. So she would come into the room and look at me, you know, checking out one of those drummers and go, okay, mm-hmm. So you want to be a drummer, huh? Mm-hmm. All right. She'd come back the next day and she had an Anthony Braxton Max Roach record. Put that and says, listen to that, and then leave the room. Mm-hmm. It was like her thing. And then she'd come back like a few months later and gave me this record called Drum Night at Birdland. Right. Bart Blakey, Elvin Jones, Charlie Persip, and Philly Joe doing like drum battles on it.
Wow.
Put that up, listen to that. Come back a few months later, three quartets. Come back a few months later. She was just like that. She just kept, you know, like, you want to be a drummer, you got to listen to this. And my sister's not a musician. She was not a musician. She's just a music lover, you know. So it's really her. So then that was the turning point where I would absorb the rock side. I never left that. And then I would also be starting to absorb this other side. And, you know, I would seek out what that playing is. What's going on there? Mm-hmm. So I decided to take a more academic route to it. You know, in Montreal, I went through McGill, and I decided to move to New York. By then, I'd married Julie.
What year and how old would you be?
So I'd have been in my early 20s.
Got it.
Early 20s, and that would have been the late 80s, so like 88. I moved mm-hmm. to New York City.
Okay.
And we both, and she came and went back to finish McGill, but I stayed and went through Manhattan. In fact, interesting story with going to Manhattan School of Music. When I went there, the very first musician I met in New York City, although I had been going there because I have family in New York, I have my aunt and cousins and stuff. So I used to go there a lot, but to go to play music, the first person I met was Gregory Hutchinson, drummer, mm-hmm.
okay.
first guy. And so we became friends. I haven't seen him in a while, so I owe him many calls, but you know, he's gone on to become this, you know, bebop star, and rightly so. He was a star then, he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I went through, so that had been early 80s, went through Manhattan School of Music, and ended up staying in New York, you know, started to get things going there. And yeah, that's kind of what it was. I met James Bud Almer, early 90s, started to tour with him. Met John Popper, toured on the rock side with him. I used to play with a guy named Hassan Hakmoun, who is a great African gimbri or santir player.
Wow.
And play with him. So, you know, the whole thing kind of started at that point.
Yeah. So go back to James Blood. What about him? How did that connect?
Well,
he's a character.
He's
a character.
And he's become such a dear friend over the years.
Okay.
You know, yeah, he comes out of Ornette Coleman, you know, the master and the harmelodic kings, I guess you would say. They Blood with his guitar work and his ability to do alternate tunings and stuff. As far as my participation, I met him very young, so I'd have been about 25 or something like that.
Okay.
You know, and it was he likes, obviously, at that time, he liked to get young musicians like he did with Calvin, you know, mm-hmm. young. I can mold them. That
yes.
kind of attitude.
Okay.
And he would rehearse for hours in his loft in Soho, me and a great bass player by the name of Mark Peterson,
okay,
and who's still in New York, still on the scene there. And he would just take us through his concept of how he saw music. And it wasn't what I'd learned in school, you know, like that was the first time I realized that you really learn after school. School is just a place that you get, it's like information.
Yes.
You get information and you don't have enough time to assimilate that information in that short period. You get information and then it's like I said, you put it in a file cabinet and over the rest of your life, you refer to it. But the real learning, like what happened to you with Mahavishnu, is out in the road, right? How to deal with people in a group, how to travel, how to dealing with exhaustion,
yes.
how to all the stuff that you gotta understand when you're playing in that. And then also, giving your very best self every gig.
Yes.
Your very best self.
So what's one thing you can say that James Blood Elmer taught you or and shared with you, inspired in you, that we can latch on to at this time of our lives?
Yeah, I would say the biggest thing, because I'm a Virgo.
Okay.
I'm a Virgo, so I strive for organization.
My son Michael is September Virgo. The 3rd, Virgo, yeah.
September,
so I understand. Yeah. What day are you?
17.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, so I'm used to things being measured and organized, and you know, if this is section A, when we come back to it, it'll be this way, and I can expect mm-hmm. these things. If this is section right. B, you know, if the room is set up a certain way, when I come back tomorrow, it'll be set up that way. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that James Blood taught me was to take life in a flexible way, and through music, if something's happening at the moment, that's what's happening. Forget about what we planned.
Yeah, that's right.
What's supposed to be there. This is what it is right now. Stay here with me now and bring all forces to bear on the present in the music. Regardless if you're going through a whole section that is completely scripted, or whether you're going through something that you've been playing every night a certain way with a certain groove.
Yeah.
You know, he would do things where we'd rehearse like a certain song with a certain feel, and we'd work on it like for hours.
Yeah.
Days even.
Days.
And then we'd hit that stage in like Vienna or something.
Yeah.
And he would call the song. And you can always see that we're ready for that thing. And he would come in at a totally different tempo, different key, different feel. The melody's still there. Everything else is different. And when I was younger, that was terrible. I mean, there's a couple of thousand people in front of you.
Yes.
And you're a kid, basically. And I used to feel really hung out to dry at first. And then as I played with him more and more, I started to understand. He wanted that spark. He wanted that energy. Mm-hmm. And I learned how to dig in deeper during those moments.
Wow.
You know?
That's a great lesson.
Yeah. And it was something that instead of being irritated or drugged about it or terrified by it, I would just kind of, now these days is the best. I look forward to those moments. Okay. You know, he's much older now, so it doesn't have quite the zing to it, but you know, he's 80 years
old. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But give him our love. If you see him again, give him our love. Yeah.
He checks this out. He's going to have a blast out of it. But you know, I just remember those early days, boy, I'd be like, why is he persecuting me like this? I used to think.
Yeah.
And then, but yeah, that's the thing I would take away is just, you know, keep yourself flexible. Keep yourself ready to move. Don't be so entrenched in what has been scripted, because life isn't like that, right? You get up, you go, you take a shower, you get dressed, you go out the door, you have a plan to go to the grocery store, but lo and behold, traffic. Mm-hmm. There's a blockage. You got to find another route. You still get to the store, right? Yeah. You have to take another route. You get to the store. Mm-hmm. That kind of mentality. And that was difficult for me, coming from a classical background, as you could imagine, and being Virgo.
Now, what about the great harmonica player, John, who we admire from Blues Traveler? How did you meet him? What happened? And tell us about your work with him, because he's a phenomenon.
He is, yeah. John, I met John Popper from friends I had. Well, to back up a little bit, I used to work with a band called God Street Wine. And they were a jam band. They're still out there, I think. Okay. I know at least the leader is Lil Faber. I don't know if I say the word leader, because they were kind of a collab kind of group. Beautiful people. And most of them were friends of mine from Manhattan School of Music. So we'd known each other. I was in ensembles with some of them, like, Aaron Lieberman, and whose dad was a great trumpet player, and Lo Faber, and we knew each other, and they asked me to play them. So I toured them for, a year, I think. Might have been a year or two. And while I was on the road with them, I kind of got into that jam band scene. So my name got to, because I went to school with a keyboard player by the name of Rob Clores, who is a great vintage keyboard player now. His specialty is B3 and clavinet. And if you want great vintage sounds, he's the man.
Okay.
And he pulled me on this gig with John, which was a real surprise to me because I loved John Popper before I met him. You know,
okay.
I hear him on the Stern Show and stuff. He's a really funny guy and just a virtuoso in every way. And I want to tell you what, he is one of the nicest people I have ever met. Mm-hmm. Honestly, you know, he was, you know, he had his issues at the time. He, a member of his blues driver had passed away, the bass player, which for some reason, all I have is the name Billy, and all the blues drivers fans are going to get mad at me now, but I can't remember his last name.
Okay.
But he had passed away, so he was in this really difficult time, and he'd made this really lovely record called Zygote, and we set out on this national tour with it. And so, you know, he was kind of hurting. He'd lost one of his best friends, and so we were there to support him through that, and he was just like an amazing guy, you know, really generous, treated us really well. You know, I even heard from him about a couple of, few months ago, I reached out to him. He used to have the song called Soul de la Canadienne, the soul of the Canadian, right? And he'd always have this big, hilarious skit he did before we played the song where he'd go, yeah, and then the army from Canada came down and this whole made-up conflict between the U.S. and Canada. So when, you know, the border shut down and all the stress of the last 4 years, I call him and says, hey, you're right. I think we're going to war soon. So anyway, yeah, he was awesome. I mean, he was just and his music was interesting. Interesting thing with him that I learned, you know, especially him coming from a louder rock blues environment.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, John liked to play kind of on the quiet side, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. I mean, so his trip was, if we can keep it down, which is great advice, but keep the energy up, like let the house make the volume happen. Let it be loud out there. Mm-hmm. And if you want more, you know, ask the martyr man for more, but see if you can back off a bit. So that was a bit of a challenge. To give it the feel like you're really digging in.
Yeah.
But just come back a bit. Mm-hmm. Just a bit. Just pull back. Mm-hmm. And I think it was really effective.
Okay.
Overall. Yeah. And it taught me a lot. I mean, it's very, very dynamic player. You know, like you have to pay attention to dynamics in that environment, in that song form, rock blues environment, which was really interesting to me because most loud groups, they kind of turn up the guitars and you and I have to kind of dig in, right? You know, I have to dig in. So it was really interesting in that respect.
I want to just because also the fact that you sat next to the hi-hat of Alvin and you saw Art Blakey and you saw Tony, those three in particular, just say something quick that you learned energy-wise or anything you want to say that you learned from either or all three of them. I just want to hear something because you were just so close to seeing that scene at that time.
What I did pick up from that, every note counts. Mm-hmm. That sounds obvious, but until I saw that, I didn't really get that. Every single note counts. Everything is like, and you've heard this, play it like it's your last note. And until I saw that, I got, play with intensity, whatever. You know, I didn't take it quite that seriously until I saw that. And that's what they did their whole lives. Mm-hmm. Like they played like their very life depended on it that night.
Yeah.
You know, I know drummers have heard that and people, they teach that in school. They tell you, play like it's your last note. But when I saw that, I saw what they meant spiritually. Mm-hmm. I saw what they meant. And that's not an easy thing to do night after night. Mm-hmm. Because your life, you carry your life on your back, right? Mm-hmm. And to put that aside for whatever long your set or your show is, and completely give 110% to that performance, that's what I got, you know.
Wow, that's beautiful.
All of them. Okay. All of them. I mean, okay. Elvin was particularly intense like that. You know, he'd be playing like, you know, a medium swing quiet. And the grunting was almost louder than the music. He was mm-hmm. so intense. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you can feel the feel was so strong internally, and every note would just sit in a certain way in that, mm-hmm. you know, in that elven way, mm-hmm. where the accents will flow as they flow. And he felt it. It's hard to describe in words, but yeah. That's what I got from that. Yeah.
You know, it hits me that you have the ability to be able to break down what people play in transcription and emotion. You would be an excellent person to make a DVD, perhaps, that just says, let me show you young drummers and even old drummers snippets of these great people who we all have learned to love. Mm-hmm. What makes their molecule DNA click? Here's right. a snippet of each one I've transcribed, and we're going to play it and show you the differences of each person. So we can kind of go, whoa, because we all kind of get an idea, but you doing that the way you can do, which I now know you can do, yeah. pretty phenomenal.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Pretty yeah. phenomenal, man.
Yeah. I mean, like back, like an AB, like back to back kind of thing.
Yes. Yes. Here's a minute or four more of Art Blakey, something that he's played. Here's another minute of Elvin, transcribe yeah. and let's play it. Here's another moment of Tony. Here's a moment of whatever that you feel inspired to do. It's just pretty incredible.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible.
Taking note.
Because in our lifetimes, we've seen these things. It's a pretty incredible time to be on the planet.
It is.
And you could say, I sat next to Elvin's hi-hat. I sat next to Art Blakey. I sat next to Tony. That's pretty incredible.
I
haven't sat next to those guys.
Yeah. Well,
you know what I'm saying? So I'm just telling you, it's pretty incredible.
The challenging thing now, especially, you know, this idea of being close to a great musician while they're performing is becoming more and more alien, I think.
Right.
In a lot of ways. Right. And in some ways not, but, you know, a lot of, I have a teaching studio. I teach a lot of kids and teenagers. Yeah. And, you know, they relate to music through technology, mm-hmm. through YouTube and, mm-hmm. You know, social media. So they are getting a sense of what's happening, but there's nothing like being in a room.
Right, exactly.
Nothing can replace that. Yeah. I think that's our savior as entertainers and musicians and artists, is that for those who are able to project at a high level live, we'll always crave that. Yeah. Always crave that. And. Yeah. You know, trying to get close to something like that is really important. That's harder in certain genres with certain artists because the spectacle is so large. You know, it wouldn't be great to, you know, sit in a club that holds 50 people and check out you too, you know? Mm-hmm. That would be right. fascinating, yeah, that's right. for instance. And that yes. probably will be impossible for an average person. So I do feel fortunate to have seen those drummers.
Yeah.
When I was young, you know, yeah. really close up, and I was so shy. I wish I was a little older because I was just too shy to talk to them after. You know, I was a kid, so it was like I get bombarded by this thing and sit in a corner and then kind of just try to stay quiet and not get in the way. Of course, now I would ask them questions and see what's going on, you know. But that's the other thing too is. I hope that younger drummers don't get sucked into just the shiniest rock, you know, whoever has the golden sticks at this time, mm-hmm. you know, to try to go back as far back as you can and try to understand the drummers from long long mm-hmm. past, because yes. that shiny rock that you're checking out so carefully
yeah.
is using all that material from, you know, 1910. you know what I'm saying? Like, somewhere that material is coming into the shiny rocks playing, or the golden stick person, right?
Yes.
So I think that's really important, as you obviously did, and most drummers did, but look back and see what do those guys do? What do those people do? How did they create this? Like, it's really quite genius.
Mm-hmm. I heard a story that Chick Webb, who's monumental in the
absolutely
in the development of the swing and jazz drum era, even where Buddy Rich mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. bowed down to say, "My God, this man," and he was tiny. He was so short. Yeah. But he would inspire Art Blakey with a drum roll and say, "Art, just go and play the drum roll. Just that. Just play a drum roll. No, keep at it. Just keep at it." Mm-hmm. So this Chick Webb guy had superior chops. I mean, great swing availability, but he was really technical proficient. You know,
absolutely. I wish there was more material yeah. of him. It's so yeah.
but, well. Quite frankly, now I've discovered something. Now it's pretty incredible. You can yeah. go and there's a whole song after song after song of Chick Webb's writing and Ella Fitzgerald singing and the band playing.
Really?
Mm-hmm. On iTunes, you can find some stuff. I found some CD stuff. There is stuff on Chick Webb. And I was like blown away by this guy.
Wow.
I never knew anything about him. Right. Then you start really like, damn, that whole era was like enamored with this guy to yeah. the point there was a big band battle between him, right. his band, and the band of Benny Goodman, I believe, with Gene Krupa right. on the drums.
That's right. And Gene
they
was
battled.
And
Gene you was know what I mean? They battled, man. yeah. yeah. Well, I'm just saying, I mean, I wasn't around. I'm too young for that sort of stuff. But yes. God dang, man. I'm a student. I'm a student, you know.
Terrifying, right?
Terrifying. Beautiful.
And then you have to wonder, well, where did his vocabulary come
from? Yeah. yeah.
That's like another thing. It's like, did he just beam in from space? Like,
yeah. what? That's a good point. They do beam in from space with all those chops and all that knowledge to show us the way.
Yeah. Well,
and now it's our job to keep it going.
They are good. They are. I had a teacher here in Canada
yeah.
who the Canadian drummers know. His name was Jim Blackley, the Scottish.
Okay.
He was just an incredible soul, and he influenced some of the best players from up here.
Yeah.
And that's what he would say. You know, if you ever encounter someone who is at that genius level,
yeah, yeah,
they're just a gift.
That's right.
That's what they are. They're just that's gifts right. for us, and they are to be cherished as such.
That's right.
You know, and to learn, right?
So here, let's scoot forward to you with my man on the guitar, Vernon Reed, who we love and adore. So now, what are you doing with him? What's happening with him?
Well, you know, I talked to him a couple of months ago. You know, we check in from time to time through this pandemic, you know. The last thing I was going to do before the hammer came down, so to speak, mm-hmm. was we were planning to do a record with James Bud Ulmer. We're in a band with him. He has a blues project called Memphis Blood.
Okay.
And it's been going since 2001, as a matter of fact. And it was nominated for a Grammy that year and everything. It was a really nice project. We did it at Sun Studios in Memphis.
Oh, the Sun Studios.
Yeah.
How was that? Was that cool?
Incredible. It was mind blowing. You know, it's a little room, right? And it's got like the parquet floor from the 50s, checkered part. And they don't use it anymore, but the soundproofing that I think is asbestos, mm-hmm. actually. you know, mm-hmm. that has the white holes in it. Yeah. You know, that kind of sound mm-hmm. lines the whole room, right? It lines the whole room. The room looks like it's about, I give it about 25 feet by 16 feet. So it's not big, not big. And it had all the pictures of like Elvis and Little Richard and, you know, all the artists that had performed, and the upright piano was still there. I'm sure it's not the same one, but then upright piano in the corner, and they'd have, you know, pictures where Elvis would sing, and it was deep. Mm-hmm. They had a new board in there. Okay. Wasn't digital, but it was, I think we did it to 2-inch tape. I think so, yeah, which is something, eh, for back that time. And it was an incredible experience to be in a room like that. And you understand why those records sounded so good. It's the room. The room with this, it was just set up just so that the room itself had a sound, which I know, you know, you have big studios all over the world have a certain sound, and they have people come in there and tweak it at the highest level. I think this was just a bunch of guys just trying to get some records made. You know what I mean? It wasn't so scientifically put together. Yeah, it just sounded good. So anyways, we're going to do another record, and then the hammer fell down. So I'm hoping that we can pick that project up again once things open up, once the border opens up. Okay. And otherwise, other than that, you know, Vernon has been a great supporter of mine, one-on-one. And he's come up to Toronto to play several times in groups that I've had up here. And they've always been a ton of fun. And we did a record with some buddies of mine up here called 13 Go is the name of the project. 13 Go, Domestic Tranquility is the name of the record. And he produced that. He produced that and played on it.
And what is 13 Go? What does it mean? Why do you have this name 13 Go?
The number 13.
Yeah.
Enough, which perks everyone's ear up because it has the moniker of being bad luck. But in truth, it really isn't. If you really get deeper into it, it also there's a myriad of reasons why it's not necessarily bad luck. And also, we were trying to say, well, every culture has a number or a color or something that has that moniker. I think in some cultures, the number 3 is a problem. But you and I have no problem with number 3, for instance. So, you know, we're trying to draw attention more to that. You know, it's just a number, ultimately. So
this is the name of the new album, the new group?
Of the new group.
Okay. And who is the group? So I understand it. Who is 13 Go?
So there's myself. There's a great bass player in Toronto who goes by the name of Ian D'Souza. I like saying his name too, because it.
Okay. Right. Okay.
And a great friend, guitar player's name is Kim Ratcliffe.
Okay.
And Kim has been on the Toronto scene for many, many, many years. He's one of the stalwarts up here. And the thing I like about Kim is that he has his feet firmly placed in the bebop camp and in the more rock fusion pop camp.
Okay.
And I really like that about him because, you know, you can bring anything to him and his ears perk up. It's one of those like, oh wow. And then right away he knows what to do, which I really appreciate. And then Vernon on top of that. So,
and Vernon's part of the group?
Well, not officially a part of the group, but
just producing, or what's he doing?
He produced it. He produced that record. And you know, my goal is to get that group out there on the road. And
now, is this the group you're looking for the agent for, you mentioned?
That's right.
So we're looking for an agent for the 13 Go.
Especially over in Europe. It's the landscape has changed so much.
Okay.
And when I used to tour there a lot in the 90s and 2000s and stuff. Okay. So, you know, things change. Festival, the people who had the festivals change. Yes. Everything changes. It's like a new world in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And then with the pandemic, it put everything on hold. So I see that possibly as a positive in starting back up again. That's right. So
put out in the universe what you want. You want a European agent for the band 13 Go, and what is your dream and your fantasy? Just hit it.
Honestly?
Yeah.
To be able to play at the highest level in my group around the world. I really do love performing.
Okay.
I really do. to maintain my whole teaching world and to stay out there, you know. That's really it. It's nothing, you know, they say you should reach for the impossible. But the thing is, I've already done a lot of this stuff, so I know it's possible. Mm-hmm. I just want to do it.
Yeah.
I want it to be my music. I want it to be my project.
Okay. You know,
I've been a sideman my whole life, which I love, and I will continue to do that. Mm-hmm. But I also want to have my project out there.
Okay. Well, we bless you with love. The fact that you've done such wonderful things, your karma is pure. Your karma is wonderful. So God and the angels, everything around you is coming to fruition. So just keep praying on that. Keep working toward it. Yeah. And it's going to happen. It is happening.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to keep one foot in front of the other. Absolutely.
Yeah. So Aubrey, I want in closing that you say anything you want to say to our listeners to inspire us at this time. Anything you want to say, the floor is yours.
Oh, well, what would I say? Especially after meeting you, I would just say, you know, the road is going to be tough. I spent many years quite ill, as you alluded to, from my lovely wife. I had a kidney transplant, and she saved me in that respect. So, you know, when you start to face your demise as a young person, you start to appreciate, or you try to appreciate the most important things that you can. So regardless of your ambition, ultimately, you need to, you know, love the people you love wholeheartedly and work your hardest to something positive and inspire mm-hmm. others. Don't be afraid to give. That's all I really try to do. I try to give what I know mm-hmm. because I wish people had given me more in music, and many did. And because they did, I was able to, for instance, play Cosmic Strut.
Wow, man, cool. And because you played that and played it well, I'm on this platform of Upbeat Modern Drummer Magazine speaking with you. I was so impressed, just to say it again to all the listeners and fans, I was so impressed by you. You're not only your playing, but you could read that stuff.
Yeah.
I can't do that. You know, I can't do that. So the fact you can do that is like, whoa, that's mind-blowing to me.
So yeah, you can, for all those who don't know, you can find that on my YouTube channel,
Aubrey Drummer.
Go, please visit. I'm putting those videos out there, and you'll find stuff from all kinds of guys, from, you know, Philly Joe, Tony. I just did a thing on Max Roach, Sandu. That's somebody. Wow. Painter. Mm-hmm. He's like, that guy, he used to paint.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yes.
So please visit me there, and don't hesitate to reach out. I love hearing from drummers. A lot of people reach out. It's one of my favorite parts of that.
How do they reach out? Give us the best way to find you.
You can get me on Instagram, directly on YouTube. You can comment, and I'll hit you back. And I have a Facebook page, Aubrey Dale. You can reach me there as well. You could also reach me on my Facebook group, Aubrey Drum Lessons. Mm-hmm. So multiple platforms you can check me out. Yeah.
Aubrey, you're incredible. And then you're being so kind to me. I asked you, would you transcribe Eternity's Breath Part 1
from Yeah.
And you started doing that. So thank you for that. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah. I'm pressing it yesterday. I was going, oh my goodness, okay. That's a nice thing for the we used to play the two bass drums back then.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. You had them tuned differently, am I correct? You had that correct?
Always. Yeah. I tuned the low on the left side lower to be more the under earth.
Yeah.
In fact, in concert, I really like to use it because, you know, you got your right, you know, your jab. But when you go to that left, it's like it's meant to be like a starting some stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to start some stuff, you know.
There's got like a sub thing happening.
Yeah, that's right.
They even captured, oh man, that was a Gretsch kit, right, back then?
Yes. It's a Gretsch kit that was designed for me to be a strong and powerful and loud. So it was painted on the inside with a double coating of this enamel shellacking that made it really come to life, like pow.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what it is.
Because that recording, Visions, and also Apocalypse, mm-hmm. the way the drums cut Like, it just perked my ear up, especially like the kick drums. Mm-hmm. Man, you know, it was really unique in drum sounds of that time.
I have to thank Frank's drum shop, Frankie Polito in New York. Oh. And he had this gentleman working there who knew how to give me the sound that I needed for the Mahavishnu Orchestra. You know, you couldn't just play any drum. You had to have a certain thought about what will cut. And they put their mind to it. And they gave me, they said, if you take this drum and you repaint it for you twice round, it will give it an intensity that you're looking for.
Right.
And they nailed it.
They so really
Frank's Drum Shop. You have to thank Frank's Drum Shop.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Cause there's some live footage of you too. And that same sound, it's like boom, like it gave you an immediate presence. Right?
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I'm getting all this backstage stuff. This is great.
Yeah. Yeah. Aubrey, I want to thank you for your time today and for your love. And we're here to support you. I want to see more of you. I want you to come down and visit our studio. I'd love to have a lesson with you. So get down here when you can.
We'll have a lesson.
Yes. And just anything that you need of us, we're here for you. I'm a big fan of yours. And I'm just so happy that you took upon you to learn a piece of ours so I can go, whoa, now you're really in my heart. So God bless you, man. And anything you might need of us, let us know. And I want all the people around the world to really know that Aubrey Dale is someone in my heart that I really am impressed by, not only by his playing, but as a person. And I think you have it all going on. And we just want to make sure that for the futures, 13 Go gets out there, finds the right agent. All your dreams are coming true. Any way we can help you, we're down with that, man. God bless you. Love you. Modern Drummer loves you. And stay happy as you are.
Oh, thank you, Narad. I appreciate it so much.
Okay, brother. All the love.
Bye-bye,
honey. Bye-bye. Well. I told you, he's phenomenal. Phenomenal. He can write these things, transcribe these things, play them the way he plays them. Odd meters, whatever he's doing is incredible. God bless everybody today for watching the beautiful interview with Aubrey Dale. And stay tuned for our future episodes coming up. God bless everybody. We love you so much. Stay encouraged. Stay happy. You know what I mean? Life is a gift. And breathe deep. And this is your brother, Narda Microphone, saying love you so much. Bye-bye. Ow!
Thank you, everybody, for watching this week's Modern Drummer Podcast. Stay tuned for next week's episode exclusively on Podcast One. Until then, stay safe and healthy, and thanks for listening and watching.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.